Okay, tonight is our 29th class, and we are starting Section 2, Chapter 5 of Derech Hashem, How Providence Works. So I'll just start by reading the first paragraph, and then we'll talk from there. So until now, we've been discussing the rules of providence. We will now discuss how it works. In general, when we speak of God's providence, we are discussing two things. One involves God's perception, and the other, his influence. So we're already in chapter 5, and this whole section is about providence. So this is the fifth chapter in providence, and we have three more to go, I think. Let me just check. Three more to go, that just so we can see where we're holding in the book. So this chapter is how providence works. The next comes the system of providence. Then comes the influence of the stars. And then comes details of providence. And after that, we move on to souls and their influences. So it's a whole eight chapters on how providence works. So let's first look at the word for a minute, hashgacha. So the name of this chapter is Ba'ofen HaHashgacha. So a hashgacha is the word for viewing something, watching something. So we use that for hashgacha in kashrus, for instance. Somebody's watching over it. So that would be the first meaning that we say in this verse, in this sentence. One involves God's perception. So that's his ability to see things. And in Hebrew, it's hashkafato, right? So hashkafa and hashgacha are the same in this sense. Lahashkif it's interesting, shkufiyot in modern Hebrew. Well, I guess it's only not so modern. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Shkufiyot in modern Hebrew are slides, right? So we don't have slides in modern anymore. The word slides in modern doesn't go together. Now we have PowerPoints, but shkufiyot, see-through things, are slides. Shakuf is see-through in Hebrew. So this word hashkafa means outlook or vision. So we use that word to mean Jewish philosophy, hashkafa, right, how we see things. And then hashgacha is also something that is seen, but it has two meanings. So the first meaning is how we see things, or how, in this case, how Hashem perceives the world. And the second meaning of the word hashgacha is Hashem's hashpa'a, his influence, hashpa'ato. So hashpa'a is influence. In the Chabad custom, a person is supposed to have a mashpia, somebody who influences them, their influencer. So that might be an older friend or a rebbetzin, a rav. But it's different than a selcha rav. They have probably, I guess, four dictates, a selcha rav, k'nelecha chaver, ha'amidu talmidim harbe, ve, a selcha mashpia, or k'nelecha mashpia, that you're supposed to have somebody who's an influencer in your life. So these are the two meanings of the word. Hashgacha is how God perceives and how God influences, and that's what this chapter is going to speak about, is the how. So with regard to God's perception, we are already aware that he knows everything. It's absolutely impossible that he'd be ignorant of anything, either in the past, present, or future. Everything that was or will be was foreseen by God from the beginning of time, and nothing was hidden from him. Everything that exists is revealed and known to him in its every aspect. Absolutely nothing is concealed from God, and his knowledge is not bound by time. So, of course, Hashem exists outside of time. Hashem created time. Time is a creation for us to be able to perceive things and make sense of things. But Hashem is not bound by time and therefore knows everything, even in the future, because there is no time for him. He's above it all. So then where do we say that Hashem looks at things? What does that mean? So this next paragraph, we say that God scrutinizes things, however. So we're using that word again. Omnam nikra shehu mashkif al hadvarim, mashehu dan otam. So it's said that he scrutinizes them when he judges them or issues a decree regarding them. This is then bounded by the time during which he wishes to act upon these things. This concept will be discussed further in the next chapter. So we will extend that in the next chapter. But just to think about when Hashem scrutinizes something and judges it, so then in a way he's entering into the system of time to put boundaries on that thing that he's examining So of course God knows it anyway. It doesn't have to do with God's knowledge. But when we say God's looking at something, it means he is taking something, he is creating a finite chunk from the infinite knowledge that he has to, so to speak, pay attention to that at that time in order to make a ruling about it. So we'll go into that more in the next chapter. Okay, any questions up till here? Because we can go right on to, might even be able to do this whole chapter tonight. We'll see.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, three. When we speak of Hashem's influence, we are speaking of the system and order that he desired to make use of in translating his will into action. Okay, so this is a very important sentence. So when we talk about, of course, Hashem can influence whatever he wants, but the question is, what is Hashkacha? We're talking about, and here the word in English can help us, providence. Divine providence, or we talk about Hashkacha Pratis, Hashkacha Kalalis. When we're talking about that, what do we mean? So it's about the system through which Hashem translates his intent into action. Right? So there's a system and order that he translates his desire into behavior. And that is the system of Hashkacha. God arranged all created things in a system of steps and sequences, this being the system that he desired. Just as he desired that the sequence exist in the nature of things, he likewise willed that it exist in their maintenance and function. Through this system, all details of existence are sustained and influenced by God as he desires. This is true of every process and relationship. So, let me just read you a few sentences in the Hebrew. Just because you'll hear a word that's coming up here. V'hine b'hayot she'sider, let's see, I have to get close to the page here, b'riyotav b'seder hadraga v'shtal shalut mipnei she'chafetz b'seder hazeh, right? So we have seder, seder, seder. Now it's interesting that on Pesach we have a seder, and we understand that Hashem created the world through seder. He made a seder. So when we do the Pesach Seder, we're entering into the process of, in a way, the halachta b'drachah of walking in Hashem's ways through performing a Seder, through entering into Seder. And in fact, the whole lead up to Pesach is we're trying to make Seder out of our homes. That's why we so easily cross over from getting rid of chametz into spring cleaning, because we're drawn to the Seder of it, right? We're really, the halacha is get rid of the chametz, and yet we keep trying to make Seder, at least I do, attempt to make Seder during that time and have to be reminded, no, it's not a time, making Seder is great, but you don't have to make Seder out of everything. You have to get rid of the chametz. But the idea is that pre-Pesach, excuse me, and Pesach, which is one of the times of creation, creating the Jewish people, but even possibly of creation of the world, you know, we have that machloket between when is the world created, in Elul or in Nisan, but that the world is created through Seder. So here we have, he's discussing the Seder that's used to make Hashem's will manifest. So it comes through a whole process in a Seder. So here is the Seder. God thus first influences a malach, who in turn influences another malach on a lower level. This continues step by step until the final malach acts upon a physical thing. This can either sustain this thing or bring about something new, all according to the decree ultimately emanating from Hashem. The sustenance of everything that exists on every level, however, ultimately emanates only from Hashem. It is Hashem's power that sustains all created things as well as their order, each one in its particular aspect. Things that occur in the physical world, however, must be brought about through a system of entities and their relationships discussed earlier. This, in turn, must follow the sequence that we have mentioned. So again, there's sequences. So starting from Hashem and moving down into concrete reality, there's many different steps and sequences. And there's all kinds of levels of malachim, which I think we'll get to later on. Different levels of malachim and forces. We talked about angels and angelic forces and forces and how they all work. The Rambam discusses it in detail in his Sefer Hamada. I think where, in which, halacha by notes and Sefer Hamada, all the different levels of malachim and how all the different circles work. So we know it goes from malach to malach, malach here being messenger, or again, we can translate it as a spiritual robot, meaning there's a computer chip that's put in, but nothing that's not programmed can function. So computer chips work well as a parable, because you have to put, even if it's a smart computer chip, it still, so far, we haven't figured out how to make computers think for themselves. We might be on the edge of that, but we're still in a place where it has to be programmed in order for it to be there. Whatever you want to get out of the machine, you have to put into it. So Hashem programs every malach. There is no such thing as a malach that thinks on its own or does what it wants. Even though we have stories that sort of sound like that sometimes, that's not the case. Every malach can only do what Hashem programs it to do. So it's a spiritual robot. It only can do what it's programmed to do. And it has a job that it's supposed to accomplish. So each malach has its task, and then can, but some of them, some of their task is to obscure the light of Hashem, to and to distance the will of Hashem from the world, so that the energy of Hashem can be used in the world. But it comes all the way down to, in a way, the tiniest malachim, as we've heard, you know, that say, that strike a blade of grass and say, grow. So it doesn't mean that we have to imagine the whole world populated with little angels everywhere, but that there is a spiritual force that causes something to grow, and it won't grow without it. But that spiritual force does not have its own energy. It emanates directly from Hashem, or indirectly, but definitely emanates from Hashem. So there's levels. It goes through levels, down and down from Hashem's desire, down through levels of malachim, until the level that actually manifests in the physical reality. Let's see. Is this the place I have a story to bring to you? Okay, but that's going to be in the next. Okay, good. Okay, God created a directing angel over everything that exists in the physical world. He likewise gave each of these angels such a nature that it should remain at its post and sustain what is placed under its hand. It cannot be removed from its post except through the system set up by God. Thus, for example, there is a directing angel associated with trees, and its task is to strive to sustain these trees. When a decree is issued by God, however, the directing angel of the wind may be strengthened to the extent required by this decree. The angel of trees can then be pushed aside, and some of his trees torn up by the wind. Within this general concept, however, there are many levels and details. There are angels assigned to oversee the laws of nature and strengthen the various aspects and processes of the physical world. Above them are the angels involved in carrying out decrees concerning reward and punishment, and according to such decrees, these can prevent the angels of nature from functioning. All this involves many details according to God's unfathomable hidden ways. Okay, so now I'll tell you a story and then tell you what's happening in Colorado. So it's clear that Malachim are the agents that Hashem chooses to use. This is the system that he has set in place to run the world through these agents. And that different things may be set aside for the purposes of making things work. So there's a story. I'm not sure where the story is found. I tried looking it up before, and I found it actually interesting. I looked it up online. It's of King Solomon in the Malach HaMavet. I found a lot of Muslim sources for this story, or Muslim retellings of this story. I did not, and I found a few Jewish ones, but none of them had a source. So it's probably a Gadita. It's probably in the Gemara. It's a famous story. Anyway, here it is. So King Shlomo had his court, and he had some courtiers that he really appreciated. The advice that he got from them, the interaction that he had with them, he really appreciated their advice, their counsel, and their relationship. One day, he saw the Malach HaMavet. Now, King Shlomo knew how to speak to the Malach HaMavet. He had interactions with him. He understood some of the secrets of discussing things with Malachim. So the Malach HaMavet appears in his court one day with a dejected face. And Shlomo HaMelech looks at him and says, Malach HaMavet, whatever he called him. What's with the long face? Why are you so sad? And he said, I'm so upset. I have to take the life of these two courtiers that you love so much, and we're friends, and I know you're friends with them, and I'm just beside myself. I so don't want to take their life, but that's what I was told to do, and I have to do it, and I'm just so sad about it. So Shlomo HaMelech says, oh, thank you so much for telling me. I really appreciate you giving me the heads up. I'm going to send them right away to the city of Luz, where they'll be protected. Now, the city of Luz is a city in which no one died. They aged, but they didn't die. And I'm not exactly sure the connection with the Luz bone that we have the tradition of having that was created after Shabbos, so that when we eat, this is just parenthetical to the story, when we eat the Malav Malka, Motzei Shabbos, we're feeding that bone that was created Motzei Shabbos, and that's the only bone in our body that didn't participate in that first chait. So that's the bone of eternity in us that wasn't affected with the decree of death. So when we eat the Malav Malka, apparently we're feeding that bone and feeding our eternity. And we also have a tradition that when we're resurrected, Tcheyas HaMesim will begin with that bone, with the Luz bone. So now there's the city of Luz in Eretz Yisrael, and Shlomo HaMelech sends his two courtiers to the city of Luz. He tells them, calls them into the court, and he says, I have a special mission for you. Please take this message to the city of Luz. Off they go, riding on the horse. And he's thinking, oh, terrific. They are saved. No problem. The next day, he finds out that they were killed right at the entrance to Luz. And he can't believe it. He's like, what? I sent them there. And he sees the Malach HaMavet, who is smiling the next day. And he comes in and he speaks to Shlomo. He says, oh, thank you so much. And Shlomo HaMelech says, what do you mean, thank you so much? You killed my two courtiers. He said, I had to kill your two courtiers. He said, the reason why my face was so sad yesterday is that I was supposed to kill them right at the entrance to the city of Luz, and I couldn't figure out how in the world I was going to get them there. Right. So that's a famous story. Which just shows that, I mean, the main part of the story for us anyway is to show that you can't thwart the Ratzon Hashem. Hashem's going to do what Hashem needs to do, and the Malachim he sends are going to make it happen. And we basically function to play into that. However, we can play out of it a little bit, meaning Ein Mazal Yisrael, we don't have to accept what is sent to us. The gzeirot that are decreed for us don't necessarily have to land on us if we do the appropriate tshuva or become the people that we need to become. Or they do need to, depending on all kinds of different factors. So let's just look at how different factors might work in accordance with the paragraph that we read before. Right? So that there are angels assigned to oversee the laws of nature and strengthen various aspects and processes of the physical world. So let's just look at the state of Colorado right now where there's fires all over the place. Right? So there's Malachim in charge of the trees, in charge of the old growth forest, in charge of the, you know, they have little patches of small pine trees being grown for commercial sale in December. So there's Malachim in charge of those, too. And there's Malachim in charge of the lakes, in charge of the snowpack, right? There's Malachim in charge of all the different things, and there's Malachim in charge of the forces, right? There's a Malachim in charge, or Malach, I don't know how many Hashem appoints, in charge of gravity, right? Keeping everything down when it falls. And Malachim in charge of making gravity not too strong so the tree can grow up in opposition to that force. Right? Whatever it is, there's all kinds of Malachim at work. And then at some point, they have to be increased or decreased. So let's say, right, that a forest has to be, for whatever reason, a forest has to be destroyed. Now, we know that a fire helps spread seeds. It opens up pine cones that releases seeds that allows things to be planted in the wake of the destruction. And sometimes that has to happen to clear out an area. So let's just say that for whatever reason, the forest needs to be thinned. So now the malach of the forest is going to be weakened and the malach of the fire is going to be strengthened so that it can go through. Now, it would be possible to make the fire so hot that nothing could remain, or to make it burn so wide that all animals would be consumed in it, or whatever it is. each fire has to have the power that it's supposed to have. So the malach of that fire will be increased to give it the ability to power the fire to the extent that it needs to be powered. And the malachim of the different animals or species that are in the way of the fire will then be weakened or be caused to do whatever they need to do to allow the fire to destroy what they're charged with keeping going. And then that comes into interaction with other things, like, for instance, in Colorado. So the winds were strong and the fire was burning, and exactly what the firefighters hoped wouldn't happen did happen, and the fire in Colorado Springs jumped a canyon, a whole canyon that was a break between the forest and the town. Mm-hmm. So now the fire is burning the town, and 32,000 people had to be cleared out of their homes, evacuated from their homes, including the Chabad rabbi and his shul, their mikvah. And they were evacuated without much chance to take anything. I mean, we often play that little mind game, you know, what would we take with us if we were had 20 minutes to pack up? And it's easy for us in a later stage of life to think, oh, well, I would take wedding pictures, I would take, you know, my candlesticks, I would take whatever precious things, you know, as much as I could grab of those precious things, memories that can't be replaced. But let's say you're a young mother with young children, so what you have to take is food, medicine, clothing, toys, you know, what's gonna sustain you in a shelter? You know, you don't have a chance to look for your wedding pictures or take your candlesticks. You have 20 minutes, right? So, or not. So they didn't. They were told to evacuate, and they had to evacuate. They weren't even able to go to their shul and take out the Sefer Torah. They did later get permission to go back in, and they had 15 or 20 minutes to grab a few things, including the Sefer Torah. But just imagine what it's like. So now the hashgacha of that Chabad family interacts with the hashgacha with the hashgacha of the family, which is not controlled by malach, interacts with the malach of the non-Jews who live in the neighborhood, which interacts with the malach of the fire and the malachim of the things that are growing in the area. Right. So there has to be a very sophisticated system that allows the fire to progress where it's supposed to progress and be stopped by prayer in some places and not stopped by prayer in other places, and all the different systems that are in place. So all of it's a very sophisticated system. We'll see a little bit more about it in the next chapter. But just to know that it's not a simple system, and it's not a system, this is not an explanation that supersedes science. We understand, we learn through science how different things work. This is a spiritual explanation of what causes those things to work or what gives them power. Why does a fire jump a canyon? Right? So you could say, well, yes, there's winds that blow it, and it was very dry. We didn't get the snowpack that we expected, whatever it is. But the reason why it jumped a canyon is because Hashem said it's time for those houses to burn.
So he
arranged it that the wind would blow. He arranged it previously that not enough rain would fall. He arranged it that it would be so dry and catch so easily, right? That all took place beforehand, setting up the conditions for those people to be impacted upon. So that's the hashgacha that we're learning about, is what is the system through which Hashem makes his will manifest. So it's not lightning bolts from the sky, but rather subtle, what looks like subtle systems being set up, but of course they're very intricate and broad and planned out. Okay, paragraph 5. God himself oversees all things above and below, roots and branches. He constantly takes into account the ultimate general perfection, and all creation revolves around this point. This general concept then affects each individual according to his particular readiness. On the basis of this, it is decided whether he should be drawn close to God or cast away, and whether he be purified by suffering or left alone. Each individual is dealt with according to what he deserves, in such a manner as to advance the perfection of creation as a whole. So as we discussed about the fires and seeing the complicated way that different malachim can be at work in different levels of strength in order to make something like that happen, But we have to remember that through all that, Hashem is in charge of the whole thing, roots and branches, and he's constantly looking at the entire picture, what will assist the whole world in coming to a place of shlemus ultimately. And then each individual cog in the wheel, he looks at each one, and each person is dealt with according to what he deserves, vis-a-vis the whole. So that Hashem arranges everything so that each person will be part of the whole picture, whether they're purified, whether they're left alone, whether they're drawn close or cast away. Each person is going to be dealt with according to what they deserve and according to what the system needs for the whole system to work. Okay. Paragraph 6. When he wills, Hashem can change the order of creation at any time. He can bring about various miracles and wonders as he desires and deems beneficial for creation according to the time and circumstances. So even though he sets up a whole system, it doesn't mean that he's bound by it. We're bound by it, generally. Regular human beings are bound by it. But Hashem is never bound by it. Even though he set it up, he's not bound by it. He can do whatever he wants with it. This might seem to contradict what our sages teach us when they say, in cases where miracles occurred, God made specific conditions with all of creation. The statement, however, does not mean that in cases where Hashem did not make such conditions, he can no longer change things. So this is according to the view, I believe, of the Rambam, who does not hold by miracles. The Rambam believes that everything was pre-programmed into the world. So while he certainly wouldn't deny the splitting of the sea as a miracle, he would say that didn't just happen as a transcending nature at the time, that was actually pre-programmed into the nature of the sea, that it would split at this particular time. So it was actually Derech HaTeva, even though we call it a nace, he holds that it wasn't. So I think that's what he's referring to. So that God made specific conditions with all of creation. However, that statement doesn't mean, the Ramchal says, that in cases where God did not make such a condition, that he can no longer change things. This is not the case, for God can definitely change things as completely as he wishes at any time he pleases. So while God sets up a system and prefers to work within that system, he can certainly step out of the system anytime he wants to cause things to happen that he needs to happen. And while we do definitely have the concept, Ein Somchim Al Hanes, where you don't rely on miracles, I think it was Ben-Gurion that said that relying on something, I'm going to mess up his quote, but basically I'm paraphrasing, relying on miracles is foolish, but denying miracles is ignorance. That he, even Ben-Gurion, a non-religious Jew, totally understood that miracles absolutely happen for the Jewish people. So you shouldn't rely on them, but you can't deny that they're there. It's definitely part of what makes us sick. What our sages is teaching us is that at the time of creation, God showed and informed the roots of all created things of their true essence and nature, as well as the purpose for which they were created. He furthermore showed these roots everything that they were destined to bring about throughout history, as well as their ultimate destiny. They realized and knew that everything was directed toward a genuinely good purpose, and therefore rejoiced and were satisfied. This is what our sages meant when they also taught us everything in creation was first asked if it wanted to be created and agreed. So here's an interesting concept, right? So first of all, we have God talking to the roots of all things. So what does that mean? The roots of the ocean, the roots of the trees, the roots of the wind. He's showing each one of those roots the ultimate end of everything and the role that they're going to play in it, and they see that it's all for the good. So even the root of the ocean that held the tsunami that destroyed part of Japan, the root of the earth underneath Japan that quaked so mightily that it moved Japan a foot over, however much it moved it, the whole island. You might think, if you could say this, that they feel bad about doing things that are so destructive or so harmful. But in the end, they understand that what they're doing is ultimately good, and so they're happy to do it. Now, why do we need happiness? It's interesting just to think about that, too. Who says that the oceans, the mountains, the trees, the whatever roots of everything have to be happy? But if we understand that Hashem is intrinsically good and ultimately good and is a giver of good, then of course Hashem wants everybody to, in the end, be happy about what it's going to be. So they, at first, are happy about it, and we say in Shir HaMalot, Az Yemalei Tzchok Pinu, then when we understand the whole thing, our mouths will be filled with laughter. We'll get it in the end. We will all be happy about everything in the end. It's just in the middle that it could be difficult. But here in the beginning, everything in creation was first asked if it wanted to be created and agreed. So that's an interesting thought also, that everything agreed. So there was some level of free will associated with things that we don't think about having a will at all, and that they were consulted by Hashem and they did agree. And we do have that concept also, and I'm not sure how prevalent, if everybody agrees with this concept or not, but certainly it's a strong concept, that a child picks a parent, that neshama, and I don't know if we have it the other way either, that the parent picks a child, but we definitely have a concept that the child chooses, a parent agrees to have that person as their parent, or even chooses, so that it's not certainly something that you'd want to remind a child of when you're giving them a hard time, or when you're feeling like they're having a hard time from you, to say, you picked me. However, it's something to remind yourself of when you're struggling with that teenager or a young adult, that this child picked you, and you're just the right parent for them. And therefore, go for what you think is right, and you don't have to appease them if you think what you're doing is right. They chose you. Although Hashem is setting a precedent that he explained things and everything in creation was first asked if it wanted to be created and then agreed. So I think there's also quite a bit of room to not work unilaterally, but to actually bring people into the picture and show them why it's good. That being said, let's get back to our text. When God informed these roots of their concept, nature, and ultimate effects, he also showed them that their fulfillment would require them to be involved in miracles at specific times. These might be for the sake of the Jews as a whole or for particular righteous individuals. All this concerns the highest roots, and following all this, the necessary sequence was then set in motion. Everything appropriate to these roots was placed in the physical world, and directing angels were set over these things to sustain them according to the laws of nature. Then, when God willed it, it was decreed that these directing angels should suspend their function and that the natural order be changed according to that decree. A decree can be issued in many different ways. Thus, for example, it can be issued like a royal order or in a matter of the tirade of an angry tyrant. We find an example of the latter with respect to the splitting of the sea, as it is written in Tehillim, Hashem raged at the Red Sea, and it became dry land. All this likewise depends on the time and circumstances. So that's what we're going to in the next chapter. But here we see a system has been set up, and the system does not have to be stayed within for Hashem. Hashem can transcend the system anytime he wants, but there is a system. So a whole system has been set up of how Hashem affects his will in the world, how he bridges the gap between his desire and the manifestation of his desire. So that system through which that becomes manifest is called Hashgacha, and it's set up of a system of Malachim, which we will see in the next chapter, how the system is set up. And Hashem can transcend it at any time for many different reasons, in order to affect what Hashem wants to affect in the world, whether it's dependent on making the world function better or differently for the sake of nations, for the sake of individuals, for the sake of the Jews, for whatever it is. But in different circumstances, different things will happen outside of the regular order of things in order for different results to work. So I think that's why we use the words Hashgacha, Hashgacha Pratis. When we see something happens, usually it's us seeing the hand of Hashem in our lives. So, for instance, when I definitely see the hand of Hashem in my life in many different ways, but probably the first time that I saw it so clearly, I don't know if I even saw it there, but certainly in retrospect, the first place where I would notice it very clearly is when I was in high school looking into Judaism, and I was enrolled in an inner city public high school with a magnet for performing arts. So it had plenty of, in the library of that school, there were plenty of books on dance and music and theater and musical theater and voice and all kinds of things, and in addition to whatever literature. But I was looking for God when I went to the library. And on the bookshelf was the book To Be a Jew. I don't know why it was there. It didn't belong there. It did not belong in an inner city, difficult school with gangs and performing arts. Performing arts trying to dilute the gangs, right? Why was that book there? I'm sure it was there only for me. It didn't belong in that library. But it was definitely Hashgacha Pratis. Hashem arranges the world. And who knows how he put into the mind of whatever librarian when she was looking through a catalog, buy that book, because eventually you're going to have a student who's going to need to check it out. So it's definitely, there's all kinds of different ways that Hashem makes the world work. And he picks how he wants it to work. You know, which person who's coming to Judaism should meet a Jew, meet a religious Jew, meet a non-religious Jew, have a good experience with a Jew, have a bad experience with a Jew, watch a movie, see a play, find a book. You know, there's so many different ways to come in. And Hashem picks which way for each person. But that was certainly there for me. And, of course, you know, so many other ways in my life I can see. Hopefully we can all count many, many different ways. But that's what Hashgacha is, how Hashem makes his will manifest in the world. And that's what this chapter is about. And next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to see the system more up close. So this chapter was that there's a system and that Hashem is not bound by it. And the next chapter is what the system is, with more details.
All right.
So... good. On that note, it's a shorter class than usual. Any questions?
No, that's fascinating.
So, good. Well, I hope
thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll be in touch. I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember when we are going to have a conference call, memorial conference call for Bela Burnham. I don't know if that's next week, if it's instead of our class or not. I don't think so, but I'll let you know.
Okay.
And if it is, we'll reschedule. Okay. Good.
Thank you
Thanks.
Very
Have
much.
A terrific week. Okay. Be well.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.